Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mindscape Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Carroll. And if you're anything like me, you have been frustrated at times in your life with your inability to remember things. Once you get to be a certain age, you're allowed to blame your lack of memory on your advancing age. But I think that all of us at any age are frustrated by the fact that we would like to be able to remember things that we have been through, have experienced. There's a famous fact in psychology that human beings have terrible memories and they can be overwritten, and you can think that false memories are very true and so forth. So nevertheless, there are people out there who are super duper memorizers, right? You may have heard of these memory competitions that people have and this technique called memory palaces, where you basically associate some incredibly long, complicated list of information with physical locations, either real physical locations, you know, in your house or in your yard or whatever, or made up physical locations. You build a palace in your mind. And that's, we kind of have some reasoning as to why that's true in the brain. You know, memories are about associations between different neurons, and one of the strongest things that the brain is able to do is locate ourselves in space. So associating different facts or figures with different locations in space is a great way to remember them. So today's guest is Lynn Kelly, who has a broader, much more interesting take on this idea and the usefulness of memory palaces. She's a memorizer herself. She's a multiple-time champion for the seniors division memory competitions in Australia. But Lynn has had a very interesting career. She got her undergraduate degree in engineering. She did a lot of work on information technology and education and teaching, and then decided that what she really wanted to do was become a writer. She got her PhD from La Trobe University in English as a nonfiction writer. She's written a bunch of books on popular science and skepticism and things like that. She became fascinated with how prehistoric, pre-literary, indigenous societies were able to pass down information so accurately, even though they couldn't write it down. So she began to relate this idea of memory palaces and the great memorizers that we know about to constructions that were built by these cultures before they were able to write, sort of in between when they were nomadic cultures wandering around and didn't really need to remember that much about the local terrain, and when they developed the technology to imprint knowledge and keep it for a long time. So Lynn has a theory, which is becoming discussed in archaeological, anthropological circles, that monuments such as Stonehenge are actually ancient memory palaces, that the tribal elders or professors, as I would like to call them, would be able to associate different pieces of crucial knowledge about how to live, you know, the laws of the society and so forth, with the different individual parts of Stonehenge and other monuments. And it's not just a speculative idea. It's a theory that makes predictions, and you know, there's different aspects that she says must be true. And she's been able to argue that these kinds of ancient memory palaces are found everywhere across the globe in all sorts of different cultures. So it's a fascinating topic that we discussed, both how you remember things and what it teaches us about ancient societies, and then also what the implications are for us here and now. Lynn's most recent book is called Memory Craft. It's a how-to book. It's how you can use these techniques to remember things better. She's previously written an academic book on this subject called Knowledge and Power in Prehistoric Societies, as well as a non-technical popular book called The Memory Code. And it's a wonderful combination of ancient history, anthropology, psychology, neuroscience, and education right here, right now. So this is a fun one. We're all driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. You can ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. And Mindscape listeners will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get their jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Mindscape. Just go to Indeed.com/Mindscape right now and support the show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Mindscape. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. one. I hope you're going to enjoy this podcast. Let's go. Lynn Kelly, thanks for being on the Mindscape podcast.
It's my pleasure to be here.
I will mention something. This is a bit of an unusual, you are a bit of an unusual guest for me in some sense, because I had not heard of your work previously, and I heard of it first through a commenter on the internet, Adrian Morgan, who both on Twitter and Reddit was very persistent in suggesting that you'd be a great guest for Mindscape. And more than just suggesting your name, he actually made the case. He had an excellent pitch for why talking to you would be a fun topic. So I just want to do a little shout out to him and thank him for suggesting your name.
Thank you, Adrian.
Yeah. And so I was, since I didn't know about you, and since probably many listeners also don't, but that'll be different after this, a little bit of background might be helpful. I just have to let people know that according to your CV, you got your bachelor's degree in 1972 and your PhD in 2013.
Yes,
which, if my math is correct.
And one's electrical engineering. I start in electrical engineering. I go through teaching and computing and end up in arts and humanities.
Yeah, no, I just love, you know, fun trajectories for people that are a little bit different than anything else. If my math is correct, that's a 41-year gap. And I presume you're not in graduate school for 41 years.
No, I taught for about 40 years. So I taught senior physics and maths and computing and read and wrote and did lots of things. So, yeah, it's a gradual trajectory. People think that it's all disconnected, that what's engineering got to do with Indigenous knowledge systems and memory. It all makes sense. And there's a book on spiders in the middle there, and another great passion of mine. It actually all makes sense to me. It's all about asking for logical explanations for things that some people find irrational. And certainly a fear of spiders is irrational. And living in the Australian bush, I can't avoid
that fear.
Them.
I know it's irrational, but I still have it anyway.
I don't. I overdid the cure. I adore the creatures. All my work does make sense to me, but other people see it as bitsy. But it's not.
Well, that, yeah, so it's good. That's a good segue, because we want to talk mostly about your work on memory and the anthropology of it and what it says about ancient societies. But, you know, as I'm sure you recognize, if all you told someone was that we're going to talk about Stonehenge and how ancient cultures had a form of wisdom that we've lost, you know, there's a certain New Agey woo-ish slant that comes to that. So yep. I want to give you a chance to let people know you've written an entire book about the skeptical point of view that we should have about paranormal phenomena.
Absolutely. I am rigorous scientist through and through, hardcore. I'm a foundation member of the Australian Skeptics, and that's why I keep asking these questions, because if I can't find a logical explanation, terrific, I have to change my views. And I have had to change views over time. And that's what's fun when your thinking gets knocked about. And my thinking on Indigenous cultures got thoroughly knocked about when I did the doctorate. But I always come at these things from a, there is probably a rational explanation type logic first, and then I'll question otherwise. And frankly, the logical explanation is always there.
It's always the one. Yeah, I was going to say, when it comes to your work on ancient societies, it's, you're claiming that you found logical explanations for
Absolutely.
These wonderful artifacts that we found everywhere. Yeah. And it has to do with memory. And you also, you know, you're putting your money where your mouth is there, too. You've become a bit of a memory champion at the applied level as well as the theoretical level. Tell us about that.
Yes, I get my hands dirty on everything I do. So when I did the Skeptic's Guide, I was doing psychic readings and things just to try and understand the mindset, because I don't believe that people are stupid. I believe that they're vulnerable or trusting and gullible. Frankly, I don't know the difference. Mm. So when I came to these memory systems, I stumbled over the fact that Indigenous cultures, and I'll start with Australian Aboriginal, but also I work with Native American, these Indigenous cultures are memorizing vast amounts of practical information. Everybody thinks in terms of that they've got some kind of paranormal ideas about gods and things and they don't understand science. It's absolute bunk. And so once I started realizing when they know about animals, we're not just talking kangaroos and birds, we're talking invertebrates in hundreds. So one study on the Native American Navajo shows that they can classify 700 insects and very scientific type classification with behavior and habitats and all the rest, all stored in memory. And that's mm-hmm. just insects. And when I stumbled over that, given that my own memory is naturally extremely weak, my logic's good, my memory's poor, mm-hmm. I started asking the question, how the hell are they doing this? And that derailed my PhD topic, derailed the book I was supposed to be writing, and set me on a completely new trajectory.
So what does it mean to be a memory champion? There are competitions? Oh, it's like a spelling bee?
I lost your question there, didn't I?
So I started okay, my job.
Putting these methods in practice, but I also entered the Australian Memory Championships as a senior. I'm 67 now, I think. Yes, that's about right. And so in a memory championship, you memorize shuffled decks of cards, strings of numbers in decimal, but also binary 1001, which is my favorite event, which is really weird. names and faces, which is something in practice I have a lot of trouble with, so I've developed sure. systems for that. And lists of words and so on, and you memorize them under time pressure. And I've taken out the senior Australian senior memory title twice now, and I have trouble with the stress. The competition goes over 2 days and I don't handle the stress very well. Others seem to be able to stay quite calm. In America, it's slightly different. The competition by the end is done on stage and eliminates down to people, which would be more stress than I'd ever handle.
Oh, okay. So the Australian championships are not in front of a crowd?
No. And the world ones aren't either. It's only America that
only Americans.
Decides to add this extra level of pressure.
That's what makes this a special country that we're yeah. in right now. So before we get to the ancient societies, which I think will be our main focus here, but I think that probably many listeners are aware that there is something called techniques for memory, for memorizing either huge amounts of information or very long texts or whatever. They might even have heard of the idea of a memory palace, yep. but sketch out like, you know, what we should have in mind when you say that you've developed these techniques, and so have other people, to memorize huge amounts of information very quickly.
Yes, and this is what's astounding. Until I did it, I could not believe that I was capable of memorizing these vast amounts of information. So a memory palace is basically a set of locations that you're very familiar with. So the best to start with is your house. And mm-hmm. at each location, you place a piece of information. And the brain, the neuroscience of the brain and the research on place cells and grid cells naturally associates information with location. So, for example, I've got all the countries of the world, the 242, but that's protectorates as well, otherwise we lose Puerto Rico and places. So you start the front door, so that's China, because I do them in population order, not alphabetical, because I know what letter they all start with. I want
more information.
So I start with China, and I imagine at the front door a Chinese meal being delivered, hot. I happen to love Chinese food.
Now you're making me hungry. Yeah, go ahead.
And the guy's delivering it in full Chinese outfit. I think the outfit I've got him in is from about 500 or 600 years ago, but let's not get too fussy. And so that image is very strong. I move on to the next location and I have India. And there I have a bookcase and I look under the bookcase. I've actually laid down once to watch a full Bollywood production going on down there. Now that stupid action, only done once, has got India in firmly, and then I can add all sorts of things. Third one is America, which is where I'm sitting right now. I have Donald Trump sitting opposite me. Mm. He permanently sits at a table in my kitchen.
This was a sad choice that you made. Then.
It used to be Barack Obama, and I wish he'd stayed there. I won't get into politics, but it seems to change when the presidency changes
and so on.
So I have a location that's associated. Now if I want to add, say, the States of America, I would create a story or use other things. I'm looking around where I am now because I've got the states around me. And so these methods work much more powerfully than just a mnemonic, you know, my very earnest man, just show us nature's path for the planets. People have different versions of it. Mm-hmm. I can't add more information to that. But this location I'm sitting at for America, I've got a tablecloth, I've got the legs of the table. I can add endless amounts of information. So that's known as a memory palace. And the great Greek and Roman orators, Cicero, Augustine, back to Homer, all use this method because you then imagine yourself walking around your palace and you will withdraw whatever information you want. It's unbelievably powerful. It's always been associated with the ancient Greeks. My PhD research showed that this is exactly the same method as developed by all Indigenous cultures long before the ancient Greeks. Our Australian Aboriginal cultures, and there's about 300 of them currently, date back to 60,000 years ago, and we have strong evidence of these stories being stored this way, associated with the landscape, at least 10,000 years of landscape changes at the end of the Ice Age. It's amazing research. It's coming out of America as well. These stories are unbelievably robust, and they're using memory palaces.
Yeah, and so I guess I've learned something just by reading some of your stuff, because this, I'm sure, was just my fault, but I always thought of memory palaces as being metaphorical, as being sort of imaginary places that you built in your mind and associated with things. But you're talking about using real physical locations and all the different aspects of them to help you memorize long lists of things.
Absolutely. Some people can use them purely virtually and create them in their mind. I can't. I've tried. I don't think my imagination or ability to image is good enough for that. But I learnt first from Indigenous cultures, from our Aboriginal cultures, before I knew about the Greek and Roman memory palaces. So I actually came at it from using Aboriginal people will talk about country and they're on country. Country is sacred to them, and sacred shouldn't be seen as purely religious. And as Nungurai, I don't know if your audience all over 18, aren't they? Nungurai, who's a well, Prairie woman who helped me a lot with this research, said to me, the elders were pragmatic old buggers. And in our terms, buggers is a term of endearment, but for stubborn. So I'm not being rude. She said, the elders are pragmatic old buggers. We wouldn't have survived if they weren't. And she pushed me to look at these knowledge, these stories that we're told sound superficial and childlike. That's because they are. Because you don't get the detailed stories until you're initiated. And so we're hearing what the children would hear. So you're grounding the information in the physical landscape. It's so much more robust. And then as you get initiated, you get layer upon layer of complexity.
Let's pause for a second to talk about the Great Courses Plus. I know that Mindscape listeners don't need to be told that there's no reason to stop learning just because you've stopped going to school. And the Great Courses Plus is a wonderful way to do that. It's a streaming service that brings you some of the best lecturers in the world talking about their areas of expertise. You have unlimited access when you join the Great Courses Plus to thousands of lectures on topics from radio astronomy, science fiction as philosophy, the Ottoman Empire. You can learn a new language, how to play chess, and so forth. And with the Great Courses app, you can watch or listen just about anywhere. I have several courses on the Great Courses myself. One of them is the Higgs boson and beyond. It was a wonderful, fun introduction to this discovery we made just a few years ago, one of the biggest findings in 21st century physics. So we have a special offer for Mindscape listeners. You can get an entire month for free. And to do that, you have to go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/mindscape. That's THE Great Courses Plus, don't forget the plus, .com/mindscape. Happy learning. And how much do we know about, you mentioned place and grid cells, the neurobiology of this. One thing that's been interesting to me over the course of the last year as I've been doing the Mindscape podcast is several times in several different ways, we've been getting this message that thinking and the action of our conscious self, cognition, and so forth, is not just located in the brain. It's not just a computer sort of spread out throughout our bodies in some way, right? But nevertheless, there are different neurons doing different things. Is the phenomenon of a memory palace understood from the neuroscientific point of view, or is that still a frontier?
It's still a frontier in some ways, but it's fairly well understood. And I'm working with neuroscientist Dr. Jenny Roger at University of Western Australia, and she's looking at the neuroscience. I'm looking at these memory palaces and how they match. And the neuroscience is absolutely compelling that when we think of some memory or think of some knowledge, we actually lay down a physical neural pathway at that moment every time. It's extraordinary. But it won't hang around. You need to repeat that thought and that association for it to build up and become robust. And some things become much more robust than others. Music is one that stays very robust. So you'll see people with really quite severe dementia that have not responded to anything play familiar music and they will respond. That's right deep in our memory systems through the hippocampus and the long-term memory. Place is the other one, and the 2014 Nobel Prize for Medicine went to the scientists who looked at the relationship between place cells and grid cells and so on and the way we memorize. So when we are so, if we look at this table and think America, I'm doing what's called in neuroscience a temporal snapshot. I am putting two things at the same time and therefore they're associated. So you get a lot of parents who'll say, when did that happen? Oh, my child was about six, and work it out that way. It's because you've got a temporal snapshot. So instead of letting it happen naturally, using memory palaces, you're actually forcing your brain to do what it does naturally and then reinforcing it.
It makes sense that our brains would be very good at remembering where we were in space and therefore associating things with that. I sometimes wonder, not in this context, but it's appearing to me now, has the invention of computers ruined our ability to figure out how the brain works? Because the computers that we build work in different ways, right? In a computer, the ability to remember a file has nothing to do with an association with some other set of information, but our brain naturally does that. It kind of makes sense in retrospect.
Oh, my poor brain wants to go two directions at once at this moment. Firstly, Socrates worried about writing. I hate to think what he would have thought of Google, but he warned that writing, and Plato wrote this down because Socrates, we have no written records from Socrates, but we have Plato writing down his arguments. And he argued that if we relied on writing, we would stop using our memories and stop learning how to do it. And so that warning comes from way back then. But memory palaces were taught. Obviously, all indigenous cultures teach these methods. And it was taught in classical times in Greece, medieval, Renaissance, all taught formally. And then we dropped it. Now, if you add technology as well, we are relying on secondary memory storages all the time. There's another whole aspect to this. If you use Google or something, and I love the internet and Google, don't get me wrong, but you are narrowing down to what you already know to look up. I didn't understand till I used this how a memory palace would change that. So if you just take, I've got 10 kilometers of memory palaces in action now, but stick to my country's one, which is one of my shortest. I've got all the countries, and as you walk around, you start to ask questions because I've got in population order. So China, India, America, Indonesia, Brazil, Pakistan, Bangladesh. Bangladesh is coming in just with Russia, before Japan, before Germany, before all the European countries that have had so much impact on our history and that we know so much about. If you compare Italy, Italy's right up the garden. Bangladesh is down here. So instead, my brain starts saying, why do I know so little about Bangladesh? Why, with this massive population, hasn't it had a massive impact, colonized other countries? So you start asking all those questions. Now, it's a much younger country and it's hasn't got the resources and it's been at war all the time. But I didn't know any of that. It's getting this big picture that has started me doing that. Now, if I listen to the news and anything comes up about any country, like some much smaller country, I know about its population. I can guess its population approximate, but I've got a hook. And so I'm suddenly interested in all this stuff that would have just passed over before.
And this is certainly a lesson, because I think that some people are going to think, well, memorizing long lists of things is a parlor trick. But one of your points is that making all these associations is really a form of knowledge, not just something that replaces a Wikipedia page.
Absolutely, because you start seeing patterns, which the brain does naturally, but you've got a ground of information. So I've got all my countries in the world. I also walk through history. I start at 4,500 million years ago. I'm pointing now, which is no use to you, but what, still pointing at the front wall, which is the Hadean era. And do you realize it took me about 4 years of doing this before I realized I should call that Hadean's Wall? Which Yeah, you start making these. So some people are a bit quicker than me. I walk right round the block one way and end up back here at 1000 BC. And then I walk the other block. I've got it all time scaled out and get back home at today. Well, at 1900, then I go around the garden and end up with today. So I have a location for every moment in time and every place on earth. And I hook them on. But things will get hooked into more than one location and you start messing around with it, and then there's all sorts of other methods. It all starts meshing. And when people think of these memory methods in terms of just the competitions, they have it very neatly categorized. But Indigenous cultures don't neatly categorize. They mesh everything together. So your landscape memory palace, song lines, they're called in Australian pilgrimage trails in America, ceremonial roads in the Pacific, they are one form, but then you sing and dance and perform in ceremony, which is a knowledge reinforcement, reinforcing those neural pathways, which is why Indigenous ceremonies are so important to be repeated. And so lots of methods get meshed together.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is the association with places, but like you're saying, the song, I presume that other senses, right, touch and scent and so forth might be associations we could take advantage of when trying to remember things.
Okay, now I'm going to bring out a prop. This is really, really good when you're, but you'll have to describe it or I will. This is... Well, you can describe what you see. This is actually a model of an African Lukasa from the Luba people of the Congo. There are none of the real things in Australia, but America has a couple in museums, and I examined one at the Brooklyn Museum in New York, and this is based on it but adapted for my knowledge. So what it is, do you want me just to describe?
Or? Well, so you're holding up something that is more or less the size of a book, and there's some backing material that you've decorated. So tell us what the backing material is and what the decorations mean.
Okay, the backing, it's carved, and that's a tortoiseshell pattern. And the Luba people, it's well documented, use that as a memory aid. But the front is carved with different carvings, and shells and beads are nailed on. And in the research, I read that they encoded to this little bit of handheld wood, they encoded a complete history, geography, and essentially a knowledge system, an encyclopedia. And I thought, well, I'm a skeptic. I don't believe this sort of thing.
At the time,
I didn't know enough about it. So I grabbed a bit of wood. Now I'm holding up a different bit of wood, which is actually a bit of wood from just a square bit, a rectangular bit from when they were building our veranda, which I'm now pointing to, which is again useless to you. And I just glued a whole lot of shells and beads onto it to see if this would work. And I start encoding a field guide. I've got it upside down. A field guide to the Victorian birds. That doesn't matter for your image. It does for me describing it. So I then started encoding the 412 12 birds, native birds of my state of Victoria.
So we have a block of wood in front of us. I'll show a picture of it on the blog post for the podcast if people want to see it. And you've glued, you know, it looks like something that you would sell in a store as a souvenir of, you know, the local color. But you're saying that there's a code there.
Absolutely.
And to you, there's an enormous amount of knowledge encoded in those shells glued on that piece of wood.
Right. I start with the emu at the top. But I'll go to the second bead. What you won't be able to see is that there's a little tiny speck on it. When I look at that, I can see a duck tail wagging. So this bead represents all the ducks. And I can't look at that and not see the duck tail wagging. And there's a little gnat next to it, another little speck, which in my mind is a gnat. A gnatidae are the ducks. There's 16 ducks to be memorized. Now, the first one is relates to a magpie goose. About the fifth is the swan. Magpies and swans are two of our main football teams. So I have a story linking them all of a football match that goes wildly out of control. So the Australasian shoveler is burying all the dead. The musk duck, these are Australian birds, the musk duck's off in the bushes using his musk scent for methods we won't discuss. The hardheads bashing everyone up. So I've got a story that gives me all the ducks. Now, I don't believe that all that the shoveler really buries dead, but that story gives me the list, and then I can start linking more and more on. I could not believe how effective this is, and a lot of people have tried it since reading my books and are finding the same thing. And we're using this with kids of 4 and 5.
And now, does this mean that you choose which shell to glue on there because you're going to want it to represent something specific? Or is it a case where almost any noticeable thing about the shell you could turn into an association with what you want to remember?
You can. I just did this randomly. I hadn't at that stage even decided what I was going to encode to it. When I did it properly the second time with the one that looks like the real Lukasa, I did lay out, this is a history of writing from proto-writing right down to contemporary scripts. And that is laid out. That little thing there is an Inca kipu, a knotted cord device. So that was laid out, and that makes it an absolute bludge. But even if you stick to something that has no patterns linked with it, it will still work very well because your brain will make those links. So up here, I dribbled the glue down the side because I'm not really good at craft. That happened to be where our lyrebird is, and that's Menuridae. So that looks like a man's urinated down the side of my board.
There you go.
Vulgarity, violence will always work well as memory devices.
The brain remembers those things,
which is
yes.
Why mythology, which are actually encoding pragmatic knowledge, that's what a lot of my research is about. Mythology has these wild characters, vivid stories, lots of violence and sex and vulgarity because the brain, unfortunately, I have to admit, memorizes those things very well.
None of this seems like it would be helpful in memorizing a deck of cards with a bunch of ones and zeros on it. Do you have to be a little bit different when you're doing these real-time competitions?
Not really. You abstract objects like numbers and cards have no action, no meaning, no emotional response. So what you do is you give a character to each of the cards.
Okay.
So my ace of spades is Homer. My two of spades is Pythagoras. Now, Homer and Pythagoras both wear togas, so that became a problem. So I converted that over to Homer Simpson.
There you go.
So now I've got Homer Simpson as my ace of spades. My two of spades, Pythagoras measuring out triangles and things. Let's just take the Eight of Diamonds is now a snowman for me. So if I get those three in a row, I will have Homer Simpson measuring a snowman. So I've now got an active image, and I place that in the first position in a memory palace. So when you're memorizing a deck of cards, you're creating characters and story. And characters, if I can get nothing across more than this, if you add character and create character out of abstract objects, that makes them come to life and you can then create memorable images.
This episode of Mindscape is sponsored by BetterHelp. What's the first thing you would do if you had an extra hour in your day? nap, go for a run, read a book? A lot of us ask these questions, wishing we had more time. But the question is, time for what? If you had unlimited time, how would you use it? Therapy can help you find what matters to you so you can do more of it. And if you're thinking about therapy, BetterHelp is a great way to start. What I like about BetterHelp is it's so easy to start. It's entirely online. It's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. So learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/mindscape today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/mindscape. And the Greeks clearly did this. Do, yes. do we know that they did this because they said that they did this?
Absolutely.
We have records of the Greeks explaining how to memorize big things?
Absolutely. They wrote, Cicero in particular, wrote quite a lot on memory. And at his time, he was very famous for his writing on memory. So, yes, Grammatica was the character that taught grammar and mm-hmm. bashed you if you didn't get your commas right and things, except I don't think they used commas, spelling right and so on. So, yes, they created characters for all these. And those memory booklets and pamphlets and that have come down to us and were used right into the Renaissance. The same memory methods for using palaces, characters, stories, and so on. So, absolutely. They didn't
before it became
handheld devices. But that's really just a miniature memory palace.
Right.
Works in my brain exactly the same. I don't take this with me when we go birding and I memorize lists. And so, for example, we see a honey eater. We're not quite sure which one it is. Honey eaters are our biggest group of birds here. There's 36 of them. I can reel off the 36 so we can do it by process of elimination. But I don't take this with me. I know it so well that it's with me in my mind all the time.
And Cicero's techniques maybe fell out of favor once printing and reading became more widespread, once we had books to download our knowledge onto?
Once you've really got printing and that, they stop being used as much. But in the medieval times, when books were very rare, they were used in all the time. And books were designed by this principle. That's why the medieval manuscripts, which were designed to be memorized, have all the fancy stuff around. They left space to add comments in all the time, to keep interacting with it, to add little drawings. If you look at Tibetan mandalas and Chinese narrative scrolls, you've got a whole lot of ways where the memories are put into images. Now, I can read a page of a book when I'm studying and at the same time be working out what I want for dinner, and what I want for dinner will stay there. The page of the book is gone. I can write notes without engaging with them because there might be words I don't know. I cannot convert that into a story or a picture or an attachment in a memory palace without actually engaging with the information, because I have to shift the mode, the mode of information. So that's exactly what they were doing, these cultures all over the world, transferring into art. So you may have got the hint from me now that I believe that art and music should be at the heart of our school curriculums, not the peripheries, and should serve the whole curriculum. And my teaching was all physics and maths and IT. So it's not that I'm promoting my own subjects. I'm promoting something that I wish I'd known earlier.
Well, so the Greeks did us the favor of, you know, handing down this knowledge to us, but a lot of your work has been advocating the idea or discovering the idea and then exploring it that many, many other cultures did this as well. So tell us about how you began to think that a lot of things that archaeologists thought of as, you know, monuments or works of art and so forth really had this functional purpose of helping primitive societies to remember things.
Right, I don't know if you know about obsessions, but when you're obsessed with something, your brain won't think anything else. I had no interest in archaeology, but my husband Damien was really into archaeology and had just created finished an archaeology degree, his third or fourth degree, likes collecting them. And we went to England. I was researching Indigenous animal stories. He wanted to go to Stonehenge. So I traipsed along and I'm standing there looking at this circle of stones. In people's minds, when I say Stonehenge, they'll think of those great big sarsens, the huge ones, but they didn't come for 500 years. At first, Stonehenge was a circle of stones, of about 60-something stones, 100-metre across circle. Are you happy with metres? I can't convert.
Metres are good, yeah. No, I'm good. Going to demand that my listeners be able to use metres. That's okay.
And there's 1,000 circles, big and small, of this all over Western Europe, but you've also got different versions. In America, the circles at Cahokia are wooden circles, but they're the same dimensions. At Poverty Point in Louisiana, there's timber circles because there weren't big stones. So it's not the material that matters. It's these set of locations. So as I go to Stonehenge, I'm thinking, oh, that's clever of them. They're no longer moving around the landscape. And the people moving around the landscape, hunting and gathering and doing some land management and that, were not nomadic. They were mobile. They moved from location to location and knew their landscape well. So we're not talking nomads. We're talking mobile cultures.
Sorry, what is the difference between a nomad and a mobile culture?
Nomads wander all over the place, not systematically. Mobile cultures move. Ah. So our Aboriginal cultures, depending on where they are, might move between two or three campsites or even only one over the year down south, but a lot more depending on resources. So they know their landscapes.
They have a trajectory, seasonal and so forth.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
So they know that landscape really well. If they're going to settle for farming, you can't just say, okay, I'll settle today and start farming. You're going to starve very quickly. So there's evidence in the archaeology, which I can waffle on for hours, on how they gradually moved down. But these circles of stones and circles of timber and that all over the world only appear in that transition time. So at Stonehenge, there's the cursuses beforehand, like the Stonehenge cursus, C-U-R-S-U-S, which is a huge area that they ceremonial area, and it gradually got smaller until you get Stonehenge, which with these circle of stones. So if you think of that as a memory palace, nothing is going to work better because stones, and they bought blue stones over from Wales, and it looks like it was actually Welsh cultures, but the blue stones are very mottled in that. And, you know, if you look at a stone or a cloud or anything, you will see whatever you want to see there. Hmm. So, and they were all different. So they were actually setting up a memory palace. And so that was what my brain said.
Before you had that thought is, I'm not a Stonehenge expert. My impression is that people had the idea that it was some sort of astronomical or crop planting device, and you really have a totally different theory of why it was put there.
What you're saying is absolutely true, but my theory encompasses all this because they must have some way of timekeeping. If you're going to plant crops, you must know where you are in the season. If you're going to hunt and resources, and they must have still been collecting wild resources while they develop these agricultural skills. So timekeeping is essential. And we know the indigenous abilities to use the sky and variety astronomy over the year for timekeeping. The American Pueblo people are really top-notch astronomers, and Western astronomy is learning a lot from them. Our Australian Aboriginal cultures have a very strong tradition of astronomy. So that's one of the 10 points I look at any of these monuments, of whether it would be used as a knowledge centre. The spiritual stuff's all there too. I'm not denying that. But you're not going to be able to be spiritual if you're not eating. So those ideas of the practical knowledge, which is my field, is all there. Here you've got a memory palace, a line to allow you timekeeping, with ditches around it with flat bottoms. Now, nobody before has explained why is the bottom of these ditches flat. So the ditch around Stonehenge varies different bits around it, but about 2 metres deep. Now, the weather in England is appalling. And we know that the major ceremonies were held midwinter, and there's a whole lot of evidence for that. And if these ceremonies, the imperative is to perform them or you lose that information. 2 meter deep in chalk with a flat bottom, you can cover that with, and there's evidence of how they did that, cover that with hides and so on, and ensure that you perform that ceremony in white chalk. The resonance would be beautiful. The reflections of the torches and a flat bottom allows you to perform. If you look at the associated, Stonehenge didn't stand alone. So let's start with Stonehenge with its circle of stones. And about 500 mm-hmm. years in, that circle's moved into the centre, and the great big sarsens that we're more familiar with, the huge stones with the lintels on the top, are put around them. Now, Indigenous cultures all have a lot of secrecy and restricted knowledge. The reason they have restricted knowledge is that otherwise you've got the Chinese whispers effect, and the knowledge will be lost, corrupted. Now, we've got the stories here, as I've mentioned, from 10,000 years ago that are held accurately. You've got the same from Native American and Africa, and a lot of my work comes from Africa too. On these accuracy, you must have secrecy in order to only the people who are trained in the songs that store the information can actually have to be tested constantly. And they will not share that.
So in some sense, if you're just casually knowledgeable about these particular memories, you might distort them a little bit, and it would get degrading over time. Entropy, the second law of thermodynamics,
absolutely,
would kick in, which we're both familiar with. And so what you're saying is that there's a technique by restricting the knowledge to those who are really dedicated to it, you could maintain its purity in some way and keep it, as you said, over thousands of years, which for a pre-written culture is pretty impressive.
It's astonishing. One of the best studies I looked at was of the corn stories of the Pueblo people. Now, they have about 17 sub-varieties of corn and done in different colours. So the corn maidens and the corn mothers are the different colours of the corn. Now, corn cross-pollinates like you wouldn't believe. They have kept these pure for centuries, probably a lot longer, by having all these ceremonies and restricted so that the yellow corn is planted at a particular time from the white corn from the other corn, kept at a given distance, and then to eat the ceremonies that the elders in charge of the corn will select the very purest kernels to be kept. Because if you have a monoculture in the southwest of the United States is a harsh climate. So you put all the yellow corn, the nice sweet one, in, and you had a season that was really bad for yellow corn, you just wiped out your whole population. So they had this whole set of clever use of corn that ensured maintenance of a culture. It's brilliant stuff.
So you could remember things that the culture, the tribe or whatever, could remember things, events and how to deal with them, even if those events had not happened in the memory of
Absolutely.
Any living person.
And therefore it's put into ritual and song and rules and ethics and behavior of the culture that absolutely enshrines these methods and keeps their corn pure. It's just brilliant stuff.
And so they didn't have books, or they didn't maybe even have epic poems. I'm not quite sure what they had, but you're saying that at a place like Stonehenge, the elders, or I don't know,
elders,
the professors,
the
whatever.
Elders, professors.
Elders.
Yes.
They would go at regular intervals and do these rituals, and that would do, and perhaps they're teaching their apprentices,
yes,
also. And so you can imagine that there is this association of song and movement with the different parts of the memory palace to keep this cultural knowledge being transmitted safely.
And you would perform those rituals at the appropriate time in the year. So there's one part of Stonehenge where in the ditch there's piglet skeletons, 9-month-old piglet skeletons. And we know from all the agriculture that that's midwinter, which was when they had the main ceremonies. Now, a piglet skeleton was buried, and then hundreds of years later, another one was put into the wall of the ditch. So that would have been the time where all the husbandry of pigs and possibly other animals was taught. And so those skeletons would have been used as part of the ritual, but part of teaching. But then it gets amazing. Once you've got these big sarsens in, I had a problem then because one of my conditions is there must be public performance spaces and restricted performance spaces. And Stonehenge became entirely restricted. But up the road at that exact time, exact archaeologically, you know, within years though, we're not talking long time, Durrington Walls was built. And this is walking distance up the road, this massive henge. And the ditches weren't 2 metres deep. They were 10 metres deep. And they don't have any tools other than deer, stone tools or deer antlers, red deer antler. And the ditch goes for a kilometre. You're talking a million work hours. And up till now, people have not had a reason why they would do this. Now, Indigenous people do not do things for no practical reason. They're incredibly practical. So if that's the performance site, can you imagine the acoustics and vision of it? It's like a bathroom 10 metres deep. The resonance and acoustics and visual, I wanted henge ditch. I desperately want one. I've nagged my husband. He refuses to dig me one. But it must have been extraordinary. And then you've got post circles. You've got all and held devices. Because that's the other thing.
And does it matter? Does it matter that what the particular shapes of the stones that form Stonehenge or anything like that are? Or as long as all the stones are different, you could imagine associating them with different memories?
It's the difference that matters. So if you look at Avebury, which is the biggest of these stone ones in England, which also has the massive ditch in that, the archaeologists note how they seem to – all they called them male and female, but that the stones next to each other are as different as you will get. But I also took the fact that these handheld devices, the African Lakasa, Aboriginal Chiringa, I started to put these together and found them in every culture. So my logic said, therefore, they must be in the British Neolithic as well. And yes, there's chalk plaques. They're called enigmatic decorated objects. So chalk plaques, little lumps, handheld, not that little, of chalk with inscription, you know, decorated. Abstract decorations work better because you could add more meaning to it. Up north in Scotland, there's carved stone balls. So these are stone balls, the right size to be held in the hand with knobs and carvings and things on them, and nobody had a theory for them. I showed a picture of the most elaborate one, the Towie ball, to an Aboriginal elder, and he said, oh, they've done their Chiringa and spheres. Isn't that good? Now, let me tell you... So here's one of the great mysteries of the world. No one has been asking Indigenous people what these objects might be used for. American archaeologists do. But in the British British, they don't have Indigenous cultures hanging around to chat with.
Yeah. Want to know one of my favorite sounds? Here it is. That's the sound I hear when I'm learning a new language with Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. Babbel is the science-based language learning app that actually works. Babbel is designed by real people for real conversations in a series of quick 10-minute lessons that are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. I'm going to be traveling to France for the first time in a long time very soon, and Babbel's helped me reconnect with how to speak to merchants, how to order food, without having to consult a language app. Here's a special limited-time deal for Mindscape listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/mindscape. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/mindscape, spelled BABBEL.com/mindscape. Rules and restrictions may apply. Yeah, and it does seem to be, from what you've said, what you've implied, pretty universal that, you know, there's somehow a natural thing for people and societies to do, building these kinds of monuments, as this combination of big monuments with small handheld things to pass down knowledge from generation to generation.
Yes, you'll find that all over the world in that transitional stage, early agriculture. As soon as you get a big society, really big, your skill set, your knowledge elders, your professors start to get specialists. So
okay.
Knowledge is then shared between them. So in order to hold power, you then need to claim some connection to the supernatural that ordinary people don't have. And you start to get a priest class emerging, which you won't find in Indigenous cultures. So they don't talk about worshipping these ancestors and Kachina, the Pueblo Kachina and so on. They talk about learning from them, the stories they tell. They're really like the Greek gods gone back a bit more. They have much more depth and character and flaws and everything that we can learn from. So you then get and the monuments all just disappear. Stonehenge wasn't knocked down or anything. It just stopped being used. The same with the big circles at Poverty Point in Louisiana. And the big mounds are used a lot in places that don't have big stones.
I had a wonderful podcast with Mark DeVilliers on the origin of the idea of hell. And he was partly having fun because hell is a fun topic to talk about. But you're suggesting something pretty dramatic if I'm not overinterpreting it. So let me restate it and you can tell me if I'm on the right track. Back in the day when it was important to remember things for a very, very long time, but we didn't have writing or anything like that, we constructed these tools, memory palaces, and handheld artifacts to help us remember things. And we would attribute this knowledge to our ancestors since they came up with it, and we would pass it down for many generations. But then over time, as our society gets bigger, we begin to mythologize those ancestors and even supernaturalize them. Like before, it was just, yeah, our ancestors told us this. They were really good. Thank you. And then it becomes, we're almost worshiping our ancestors. And maybe this is the origin of religion in some broad sense. Is that okay?
I have thought that way. And there's others who have suggested before. I haven't used that in my doctoral research and my books because that's adding a level of controversy. At this stage, I don't want to do that because...
That's why podcasts are good.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely... There's plenty of evidence for that. There's actually examples from Native American and from Maori. The Maori can trace everything back 800 years. They did things a little bit differently from everyone else. I'll get to that in a moment, the New Zealand Maori. This is a universal thing, and I think that you can trace religion back that way, and you can see in particular in the Greek and Roman myths where they associate things with landscape, the gods all live on particular mountains and things, but they gradually start to worship them, that this changed there. And I think you'll find it's to do with power. My PhD thesis is titled When Knowledge Was Power. Unfortunately, these days I think violence and religion and money is power, but we won't get into politics just this moment. So the Maori, most cultures use the landscape and then add in complex genealogies. And this is an area that has been too complex for me to replicate. I've managed to replicate most of the others. But our Australian Aboriginal cultures will relate every single person in their culture and everyone that comes in from associated cultures into a complex genealogy map. Maori do it the reverse. They use the genealogies as the basic indexing system. And this is what Google, if it's not indexed on the internet, you won't find it. All these systems are indexing systems, knowledge systems with a complete link. Anything that's not linked to a stone is going to get lost. So the Maori use...
I can see your computer science background peeking through here.
It's actually an information technology theory. Stonehenge is a database structure with the data all stored in memory. It just happened to be human memory that died. So that's really what it is, and I do have an information technology background. So that's the way I look. If you don't have information indexed, you'll lose it. You must. So the Maori index on genealogies, they can go back 800 generations. So when you look at the mythology, there are examples from the Pueblo and the Navajo and from Maori of how those living ancestors go back far enough they become mythological. So the question, are the ancestors biological or mythological, is a question that can't be answered. That's a Western question because it isn't a significance to the Indigenous cultures because they're both. So we've got stories of the Pueblo adding in a Kachina, a priest, the priest killing Kachina who wanders around with a a priest's head, telling the story of the Pueblo Revolt and when they beat the Spanish trying to take over their lands. The Pueblo are still on their own lands. That's why they're such a valuable culture and their knowledge is so important. So they will add in stories, they will add in characters. With time, they may become mythological. It's a division that doesn't matter. So I've got Donald Trump sitting here for America for me, but he will become mythological. It's not the real Donald Trump. So
it's a technique, yeah. Yes. It's part of a story. I mean, we in post-European cultures, in European cultures and the ones we're descended from, we always lament the loss of the great library at Alexandria. But what you're saying implies that, you know, a lot of these European explorers and conquerors, as they wiped out these artifacts from primitive civilizations, were destroying libraries in a very real sense.
Absolutely. In Australia, if you use the term primitive referring to Aboriginal cultures, you would be in big, big trouble. So we'll use non-literate
or
oral.
Yeah, tell me that. I want to do it right, so please tell me.
Especially what I'm trying to say is these were extremely intelligent. They had the same human brain and still have as we have, but they stored information differently. So when, if we're talking Australia 200 years ago, the British came here and took land, they were doing exactly that, burning down the encyclopedias. So the cruelty, physical cruelty to Aboriginal people in the massacres and so on was horrific. The intellectual cruelty was just as horrific. They would put fences across these song lines and shoot anyone who came in because it was agricultural land now. So we know from the Yanyuwa people right up Australia north that there's very few elders left now. So, you know, this is knowledge that's very hard to get. But they have 800 kilometres of song lines mapped out. An elder can sing 800 kilometres of locations, can navigate them, and can associate all that information with it.
Say a little bit more about what a song line is in particular. That's a particular technique.
A song line is a memory palace in the bush. So, but it's sung because song is more memorable. So there's sung knowledge tracts, and Native American sing and dance because these are more memorable events. So they will sing these tracks through the bush. Now, people who come to Australia and decide to go out hiking in the bush can get lost and die 10 metres from a path because our bush is very dense. And any bush, you've got proper wilderness there. In England, it's a bit harder because they don't have any proper wilderness left. But to navigate 800 kilometres, and there's navigation paths right across the whole of Australia. We're talking 10,000 kilometres, you know, no, 1,000, let's not get ridiculous. That you've got these navigation tracks that go all over Australia, sung from memory, so they can teach somebody else to sing the track and navigate from a song. So that's why they're called song lines.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me wonder, like, what are the kinds of things that were being remembered this way? Clearly, maps and locations and probably plants and animals are obvious ones. You know, what other kinds of knowledge? Were there more social kinds of knowledge, like customs and laws that were passed down?
Absolutely, but you've also got a lot of other things like water holes. In Australia, the driest continent on the earth, they go right across the desert. So you want to know where the water holes are, how to find the best flint for napping, and so on. But there's also all the cultural. There is a huge base of ethical laws. And I have read so often that philosophy and ethics and everything started with the Greeks and started with literacy. That is highly offensive to Indigenous cultures because they have very detailed ethical, cultural responsibilities which keep them going. I mean, without them. So you've got stories you talked about, some of the scary stuff, the Bunyip stories here and the scary, that stops children wandering from the camp because you can't fence them. But if you've got stories of the Bunyip out there, they're not going to leave mum and dad. So although there are all these other aspects to it, being a scientist, I focus on the absolute pragmatic. And there's so much of that, I haven't run out of stuff to research.
Well, you had this wonderful example that I saw of the loon, or the red-billed loon maybe, that helped sailors or helped people out on the ocean find their way back.
Okay, it's the red-throated loon.
Red-throated loon, yes, that's close.
Some cultures call it the diver, but the Native American up on the northwest, I'm just checking my geography, northwest coast in Canada, have these loon, and they have totem poles, including the loon pole. Now, the loon is a particularly interesting bird. It's not particularly interesting to look at. It's not a pelagic bird. Now, pelagic birds are water birds that will go out like albatrosses and so on and stay out at sea forever. The loon will always come back to land at night. So if you do your hunting magic, and I hate that term because it implies it's non-rational, before the cultures that use the loon, and it's used right across the north of the world, they will sing the call of the loon before they go out and say that that saves lives, because it does. If there's a storm comes in and all the water birds will be making a racket, if you can pick out the loon call and follow that exact call, you will get back to land. It mightn't be where you want to get, but you will get back to land and be saved. And it calls, the red-throated loon in particular. There's other loons that aren't quite as good. So you, if possible, get the red-throated, because it will not stop calling the whole way back. So before, say, our Aboriginal people go out hunting, they will dance the behaviour of the animal they're hunting, like a kangaroo, because without guns, you have to get fairly close and you don't want to alert it. You don't want to yell out, "Hey, Fred, the roo's over there." So they have all sorts of communication systems which they dance before they go out in the hunt to get their strategies ready and their survival techniques ready. It's incredible stuff.
This is the kind of knowledge, the sort of local knowledge that you absolutely need, that you can imagine should be passed down from generation to generation.
It has to be reinforced. Really matters. You can't just teach a kid it and then let it go and think they're going to remember it when they need it 30 years later.
So it seems perfectly reasonable to me that structures like Stonehenge were used to keep information. They were libraries of a sort. But presumably, I'm going to guess there are people who don't agree. I mean, how do we know, or at least how do we judge whether that was it? Is it a sort of consistency check? Is it a matter of being able to fit other pieces of data into the picture that makes us go, yeah, this is probably on the right track?
I haven't had anyone who doesn't agree. Some people think I overstated, which I probably do, because there will be all the other aspects, and Indigenous ceremonies do have all the spiritual and that, which I tend to say, yes, they do, and then ignore it. I am overstating that. So I'm saying this is their primary purpose, not their entire purpose. It's a consistency. I've got a set of 10 in my Cambridge University Press book and PhD thesis, a set of 10 tests. And if I don't get 9 out of 10, it goes. And just because some don't have cave art and some don't, you know, but there must be acoustics, astronomical alignments, a set of system. If I find, and I've got tests for dismissing it, if you can find a single set of standing stones in the British Neolithic that do not follow a pattern that you can easily navigate, because it must be a sequence, a set of timber circles anywhere in, they're used in Europe, but also right across the Americas, that can't be navigated in sequence. The sequence isn't obvious. The theory falls apart. But that has never happened yet. So what I want is all these different indicators to be in place, and that consistency is everywhere, and it's only in early agricultural non-literate cultures. So it is a set of consistency, and that same consistency with non-literate cultures all over the world. So I've worked with linguists. One of the scariest seminars I ever gave was with a group of linguists specialising in recording the languages of these cultures. And if any of these cultures did not follow these same patterns all over the world, the theory would fall apart, and not one person in that room would argue. But then when you look at the neuroscience, we're just matching the human brain. I mean, in evolutionary terms, I'm talking probably only 10,000 years. I mean, Stonehenge is a mere 5,000 5,000 years, that's just a baby. So no, if I find an inconsistency, then I'll worry.
Do you know about the extended cognition thesis? Have you heard those words?
A little bit, but...
You know, there's embodied cognition, which claims that when we do cognition, when we do the sort of higher level abstract thinking, it's not just in our brains, it's in the rest of our bodies as well. Extended cognition says we should include our notebooks and our tools and our environment in literally the raw materials of how we think. And, you know, spiders offload pieces of knowledge into the designs of their spider webs and so forth. And so this is a form of that, right? Like really these things that we do to the environment, whether it's a handheld artifact that we make or a large scale monument, this is part of our thinking capacity.
Yes, I wasn't sure whether you were going into the new age collective consciousness type thing.
No, I was not.
So that's why I was hesitant. Absolutely. There's research in education that a child with a computer is in fact more intelligent because they've got more knowledge available to them. So yes, absolutely, except that if you rely on it entirely, a computer or some way of offloading your memories, you haven't got something to play with information. So there's higher levels of Bloom's taxonomy and that goes up into creativity and theorizing. I couldn't imagine that I could do so much of that until I had this base of knowledge in there to play with. So for education, I'm advocating we bring these methods back, but I'm not advocating changing the curriculum, because if you put them as art, creating art, so for mathematical tables, which people need to know instantly, not calculate up to them. Because what I see kids doing now, if they want 6/8, they calculate up through, you know, I know 2/8, 3/8 for it. If you create an image with a story, and we're using, in the schools that I'm working with, we're calling them rapscallions, because we can't call them Kachina, these characters, and take the Pueblo or ancestors or anything, because that would be culturally most inappropriate. We decided to call them cheekies to give them character until we Googled it and got a lot of bottoms. So we went over to rapscallions. So say for a tables, for 6/8, 48, you wanted an instant image. So all sixes are sticks, all eights are gates, all fours, 40s are naughty. So the kids each have their own rapscallion, and that gives them an emotional attachment. They have to create an image of sticks and gates, naughty gates. So the rapscallion picks up six, leans on a gate, and the gate knocks them flying. Something like that, which they paint. That time commitment to the single table makes them bring it back instantly. And you don't need to do the whole 6/8 and 8/6 are the same. So that's got rid of half them.
Yeah.
10s, 11s, and 1s you don't need to do because of the patterns. So that commitment in time will get every table instant.
So you're saying that there are implications for early education, but like you said, not changing the curriculum, but introducing some new techniques. And again, it takes us back to the point that it's not just a parlor trick to memorize things.
Absolutely.
It helps, if done correctly, presumably, it helps solidify the foundation of the kinds of knowledge that we have.
Yeah, I'd take out the early education. We've done research with senior secondary. So the periodic table is the obvious one. You whack it in a memory palace. Every fifth location, the ancient Greeks said make every fifth location sequence so they can get the number, the atomic number easily. Every noble gas they would bow to. So when the kids come up to number 10, neon is a door because it's a tenth. They need it, and then they bowed and apologized because it's noble gas. Killed themselves laughing. Neon noble gas number 10 is in. And from that, because they've got it as a noble gas, they can go forward and backwards and get its position and its behaviors. They sing the lanthanides, la, 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 lanthanides. They act out the actinides, which gets very explosive because they're all radioactive. Actinium, they keep thinking is a prostitute. I wish they wouldn't add that in. It gets very interesting. But so that sort of thing for seniors, we've done it with art stuff. You've got an American world memory champion there, Alex Mullen, M-U-L-L-E-N. He and Kathy Chen, his partner, are medical students, and their website, Mullen Memory, shows how they're using all these techniques in studying medicine at university and so on. So this is everywhere, and it's right through life. Because how much of dementia, not that there's a whole lot of dementias, but how much of dementia is that we stop laying down memories and identity? So instead of singing, I love you, I've lost you, I can't live without you, which we tend to sing nonstop, why aren't we singing knowledge as Indigenous cultures do? And that music is one of the last things to go. Why aren't we creating devices that are a sequence of our life so that there is our identity? And we've been doing this with some people here. And you know how kids object to granny? I've heard that umpteen times, that story umpteen times before. Oh, yeah. If you've got on a memory device and they point to it, the kids want to tell you the story. And you're creating an heirloom. And the ones we're using here in workshops here are based on the Native American winter counts of the Lakota people, where they did history done on hides. They work wonderfully. So it's early education, yep, and let's keep it going right through life.
And, okay, so for someone like me, you know, I'm a physics professor. I've not really used these techniques very well. I think that I remember in one of the things I read about you, you claiming that before you learned these techniques, you were not very good at memory, right? It was really this.
Appallingly bad.
I'll give you the chance to make the sales pitch. Like, if there's one thing that would help convince me that this is a set of techniques that I should study going further, is there something in particular I should try to either learn or help myself with, or, you know, just give a whirl to?
I think grounding the definitions is really important. So I did a physics experiment with a whole group of kids. That force was the topic that they would to do, all of them, from, and then we're talking 5-year-olds up to 12-year-olds because of the way rural schools work here and the curriculum. So they did all the experiments with balloons going everywhere and so on. At the end, I quizzed all 70 students, said, do you remember doing force in science? Yes. What is a force? 3 out of 70 told me it was a push or a pull. Lots told me it's when parents make you do things you don't want. Some told me it's what makes the balloon go across the room. And half of them said, may the force be with you. And as a physicist, you will know that is not good physics.
We hope it's not the first answer they give. Yeah, that's disappointing.
Right. Which means as those teachers are going on, you saying force this, force that, those kids are not basing any of that information on firm foundations. So the music teacher took the Imperial March from Star Wars and created a little song saying a force is a push or a pull, push or pull. I can't do it without the actions, as you can see. I'm doing the actions. The kids sang it in music and in assembly. They're not mentioned for a week. 70 kids, the same wording of the question. Do you remember doing force and science? 70 out of 70 told me it was a push or a pull, did the actions, and started laughing. Therefore, I'm not saying we sing everything. We sing or dance or perform or memory palace, the absolute things we need grounded. We must know what a force is, or else everything we do from then on is based on sand.
Well, it's a good message. There's still room for the human mind and brain and memory recollection possibilities, even a world where we can all type questions into Wikipedia or Google very, very quickly.
Absolutely. And they're fun. They really are.
And they're fun. That's the best part. Okay, Lynn Kelly, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
It's an absolute pleasure, Sean.